This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode 419 of the Outlander podcast. I am still Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Lisa S.
Continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with chapter 33, entitled The Plot Thickens.
The plot thickens, as Summer said. So it is February 22nd, 19. My gracious. 1777, London. It's a letter from Major General John Burgoyne about, he's talking about an invasion from Canada by Ticonderoga. He says, or an invasion from Canada through or by Ticonderoga, he said, would be bad. That's what the letter says. Dottie, next little whale penis thingy-majigger. Dottie must pack light for her trip to America. A letter that spring had brought news of Henry, her brother, who had been shot in the belly, but he'd made it. So in the spring, a letter had come. So if a letter came in, think about this time frame. If a letter came in the spring, that means it took at least, what, a month or a few weeks to get there. So it happened maybe in spring, maybe in winter. We don't know. He shot somewhere in the spring or late winter. The letter comes in the spring reporting that her brother's been shot. And the next line or the next notes I took were, but he made it through the winter. This dude has been lingering with a who knows what in the belly, spring at least, all summer and all winter? This is like, that's a long, you don't really consider what little words mean. Like, that's a long freaking time to not die and have to like be in a bed and, oh my goodness.
Where was he shot again?
In the belly.
Then it must have missed all the vitals.
Well, knowing what happens later in the book, yeah, I mean, it didn't pierce his heart or anything. It was in the belly and it was in his bowel. He was brought to Philadelphia. We learned that from the letter. With regard to John, in France, he hadn't found Percy. Oh, maybe there is a little bit that is not great for mom. Okay. He'd still visited the mansion or the home of the Baron Amandine called Trois Flèches, which means, of course, three arrows.
That's not what I thought.
Summer. He was, Amandine was a few years older than Lord John, and he was a little bit plump and he was short. So when he took, when Gray went to visit, he took Gray's hand, a little shock went through his hand. Remember, this dude knows Percy, and Percy had, of course, told Amandine all about John and his likes and dislikes, right?
Proclivities. His proclivities.
Yes. John, he went there to visit, obviously. He was invited to spend the night, and I think he stayed a few days. But Gray's introduced to another guest who already happens to be there, an American named Dr. Franklin. Now, we do not get his first name, but I am very, very heavily suspicious that this is, and maybe it's obvious to others and just not, I mean, it's obvious to me, but because we don't get it, I can't confirm it. I believe this might be Benjamin Franklin. I'm just guessing. When he's introduced to them, basically, Dr. Franklin is naked in a chair. He's just sunbathing. Amandine invites Gray to join him in sunbathing. Franklin gets up, puts on a robe. And Franklin also recognized the name Beauchamp Beauchamp.
I mean, everyone does at this point.
I mean,
there's only like literally four surnames in this entire universe.
He asks if he is English, meaning Beauchamp. And Gray says yes. So Gray does end up staying for a few days. Now, Dr. Franklin returns to Paris. That's another big hint that it's Benjamin Franklin, because there's a whole like, I mean, there's a movie called Franklin in Paris or something like that. Benjamin Franklin in Paris. And he does. I believe he's a diplomat. I don't want to say he has a different title, but I know he's a diplomat. But he's there representing America's or the colony's interests in Paris. So for him, for them to say, you know, he returns to Paris, which again is to me just more evidence that it's very likely Benjamin Franklin. And he told Gray that he would give several letters of introduction to several of his friends, meaning, I guess, American friends. Then we get a letter from William to Lord John, May 3rd, 1777. He is in New York. Sorry, I've not written. Nothing really exciting to report. I'm finally back in New York after receiving my orders. I never did hear from R.I. again, and he just received more orders too, to go back to Canada. William has seen Richardson, who asked him to do him a favor on the way north, to deliver a ciphered message to a group of loyalists in Virginia. Now pause for a second. I mean, there's a few things I want to ask you about there. Okay, so he's in New York, right? He's just put that in the letter. I'm writing from New York. I just arrived in New York. We know where New York is on a map. His orders are to go to Canada. We know where Canada is on the map. It is north. On no map is it south.
A flipped one it is. An upside down map.
I was about to say, okay, an upside down map. You are right. You are right. So it's north. Like, everyone can agree it's north.
Or up.
Richardson asks him to do this favor, deliver whatever, to whomever. On his way to Canada, so okay, on your way north in Virginia. So that's not on your way. I mean, it can be on your way if you're going to make a huge turnaround, but it's not on the way. Am I missing something, or do I just have to go along with it?
I feel like any place can be on the way to someplace
else. Well, that's what I mean. It's not on the way as in literally on the track you've already set, but it's on the way if he makes it part of his journey.
Right. And in that regard, everything is on the way.
If it's planned, yes. If it's not planned, then you can't say on the way. Well, in the past tense, you can. Anyway, I was just curious. So, yeah. So he, again, I'm going to read part of that again because I had forgotten it when I was taking notes for a later chapter. So the favor he's doing for Captain Ezekiel Richardson is to deliver a cipher message to a group of loyalists in Virginia. Okay, that's all we have, right? Okay, so remember that. Deliver a message to a group of loyalists in Virginia. Just, okay, think about that and then click save and put that away and we'll come back to that.
Moving right along to chapter 34 entitled Psalms.
I think it's entitled Psalms, 30. It is October 6th, 1980. We're back in the... Obviously in the 80s. We're back with the 80s. That too. We're back with the Mackenzies in Lallybroch. Okay. So Bree's schedule is basically she works 3 days a week in the office, quote unquote, you know, on site. She does inspections. And at home, 2 days a week doing paperwork, follow up, that kind of thing. Roger, so today, right now, when this chapter is being narrated, it is... when one of the days when she's at home, she hears Roger practicing his singing and she is moved to tears because, of course, this means that she's just so thankful that he has any kind of voice and the fact that he's taking an interest in maintaining of his music and his voice and everything.
Or just trying.
Exactly.
I think there was so much time when he didn't even want to try in previous books.
So Roger had gotten the assistant choir master position. He'd told the kids in the choir that he was open about it from the beginning because there's no point in hiding it or you know, trying to like couch it as something else or whatever. It's like, no, just be open and honest. He told the kids that he had been hanged in America. That's it. Like, Diana just slips that in, like, no big deal. Roger sings for the kiddos as well.
Would you have been satisfied with that answer as a kid?
Heck to the never.
I wouldn't have. That would have started
at
like...
at 6, at 40, at 80. Never.
That would have started a much longer conversation than him not mentioning it.
I mean, Because
once you've added just two tiny dollops of information in an otherwise empty story, I have a whole bunch of page to fill in.
Yeah, you know, and if he hadn't said anything, he almost would have been like, ooh, mysterious.
Right.
I can make up my own story, but whatever. Okay, so blah, blah, blah. He sings for the kiddos, and he asks Brianna, he's like, hey, do you think do you think it's okay to ask Jem to join the choir? And she's like, sure, we can make sure we can all go over to this mass. I think their church, the Catholic Church, St. Mary's, was on one side of the river, and then they crossed the river to go to wherever his Presbyterian church was.
Jem seems to take after his grandfather in most things, and we all know that singing is not Jamie's forte.
We never got a report of Jamie's voice before he had his head injury. I'm not saying he was a good singer before, but he could at least hear music before. We learn everything about Jamie's voice, I guess, but his even ability to hear tone, match tone, whatever, it was taken away by his head injury. So we don't know what he was like beforehand, but I'm not saying he was a musical genius, but he definitely had, I'm sure, some musicality compared to what he has after the head injury. So they make plans, and she's like, sure, that's a great idea. So we'll all go to church in the morning over here, and then after that, the whole family will go over with you, so you don't have to just take Jem and everything. We'll make it a family affair each day. So that goes over pretty well. So she'd told, Brianna had told Roger about, I'll use Summer's term, or playful term, about the hazing incident. Mm-hmm. I wrote tunnel activities. They're trying to figure out where she hit, quote unquote, hit this thing under the earth, right? Where this portal that she went by, through, whatever. They're trying to figure out the actual geographic location, because for their own sakes, they want to be able to avoid it, right? Because obviously right. it's under the earth, but if it's on top, if it's under, well, it's technically under the dam or under the lock, I think. And while there's no danger of her likely going back into that tunnel, they might be on a boat one day in the middle of that lock, and not, you know, maybe that's a lock that's smart to avoid. But anyway, the whole point is trying to find the precise location of any and all of these, for them, dangerous zones, right? And so this is what they're trying to do. He volunteers to go wander around the Highlands to see if he can find it. And she's like, no. And she's like, I'll go with you. That night, Roger has lodge night.
Does he ever not feel
emasculated?
Like,
I can't think of the word. Emasculated,
like,
by her.
Does she ever let him feel like he can do anything?
In what century? Like, I think always in every century, yes. It's worse than in the 18th century.
I know, but this one was
pretty
still bad, too.
The 20th is also not great.
Okay.
For his poor dude.
Lord.
So at lodge night, Roger recognizes Mingus, the headmaster from Jem's school. And one person there especially is not looking at Roger like he knows him. No, he's looking at Roger's scar. Like he's like got Google eyes for it. Goggle eyes, whatever.
I mean, it's not every day you see a dude
that's a Hank scar. I know. That is true. And the person happens to be Rob Cameron.
And she had to give him a trach. So, I mean, it's got tracheotomy scars, and he's got all kinds of stuff on his neck.
Oh, Lord. That's true. So it's not. Yeah. So he's got layers of scars. So the dude who's ogling Roger is Rob Cameron, of course. And then icing on top of icing, we find out that Rob Cameron is Mingus's cousin. Blah. Rob realizes pretty soon that this dude he's ogling is Bree's husband.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he starts a conversation like, and Roger's like, yes, she told me. and he's like, yeah, it was just a joke. And Roger, and then he and Mingus are talking more. And the last thing we hear, at least on site that night, is that Roger agrees to consider offering a Gaelic class for people who'd like to learn Gaelic.
Can you imagine the conundrum that is Roger McKenzie? Outwardly appearing, the conundrum that he presents as a person, because he's a tall man. He's not a strong-looking, capable man. However, he's also kind of a nerd. And then he also has scars on his body that imply that he is kind of a badass. Because not just anybody gets stabbed in the neck and or hung by the neck in any time period. But I don't know. It's like his professor outfit is almost like his Clark Kent uniform. And then underneath that, you can see the scars of his battle-weary soul. But that's what I'm saying. It's like he's staring at this dude's scar. And any dude who has a scar like that has seen some shit. So, but he also is outwardly a nerd who is also a preacher. But it's also like a minister and a choir teacher, a professor.
Well, also big, huge. Yeah. And husband to this woman who is out of this world. And I don't mean that. I mean that in every sense. Beautiful, overwhelming, literally out of her time. Like, Bree is very overwhelming in many ways, especially for men. And this guy married her. So, like, and got children by her. So Rob's like, what?
Right. But now, married her, did all of those things. Yeah. What is it about you, nerd? What nerd? What does he have? What does he have underneath, other than, you know, his hanged neck wound scar? His lynch scars? I don't know. I'm just saying he must be a confusing character to come across or come into contact with.
Yes, it's a lot. I can see that. So that night, Roger and Bree discuss the S&P, Rob Cameron, and then they decide to read a letter. The letter they choose is June 2nd, 1777, because, of course, Diana does this on purpose, as she should, because it picks up with our characters where we left off with them. And it's in our timeline, in the 18th century timeline, along with where we just left Jamie and Claire. It's 1777, as I said, Fort Ticonderoga. So we're with Claire's POV. She briefs them on their naval/nautical difficulties. All are well. Jamie is once again a member or a colonel of militia. Ding, dang, dong it all.
Sure.
And then they're going to take care of whatever militia nonsense he's agreed to do. And then we, for real, no lie this time, are still headed to Scotland. She's only allowed here, even though she's, you know, a doctor, blah, blah, blah. And she was working on people on all the boats and all the places and all the times they've ever been, right? Here at this Fort Ticonderoga, this American military encampment, I guess. She's only allowed to doctor women and children because there are, quote unquote, actual military surgeons there, men who have, you know, their pride. Everything is tied up with, you know, their job and their rank. And like, you will not touch another soldier. That is my job. I'm a man. I will do this. So, but she's like, okay, she can give her help to the women and children. Jamie says the fort is undermanned. It has very few guns. It is not doing great.
Do you think, what if it's not just, I'm just thinking about all the medical men wanting to save face and be like, they don't want Claire to be involved with they need to be important. What if it's their need to be important as a doctor, because if they're not being important as a doctor, they're being cowardly for not being out fighting?
I mean, possibly. The thing is, their role as a doctor, because they had, you know, they went to school or had training or something years before this moment. And so I don't see that necessarily being their struggle or even observed or observable possible struggle. I don't think they had a problem with that, because they're also in danger, right? If there's a full on, you know, layout. If there's a full on fight battle, I mean, at that point and at this time in history, today things have happened, but generally if you're wounded or if you're a doctor or if you're one of the wounded, you are in You can still be in a military zone or in a war zone, but you're generally not on the front line unless you've just been injured and you haven't been taken back to a medic hasn't gotten you or whatever. Generally, if you're the doctor doing the doctoring in a place where all the people are kept, you're not like literally on the front line, right? And right now they're not actively fighting. They're building up the fort. And I mean, the war is active, definitely. But right at this moment, there is not fighting. There's threat, though, always threat. But my point is, I don't think people generally think, oh, this dude's part of the military, but he's a doctor, or not, but he's a doctor. And he became a doctor because he was too chicken to actually fight. I don't think so. I don't think that's generally a thought.
No. It was apparently just me, just a thought to me.
No, it's not, but it's, I don't mean you can't have a thought. I'm saying, I don't think it's generally thought of in the military, a military, but she definitely gets his gander up or whatever you want to call it, because somehow, some way, and here's the laughable thing, right? He says you may not, or, you know, he basically says you have to do women and children. If anybody, you will not touch the men. That is my job, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Right. The weird thing is, like, so no one's actually challenging him. She wants to help. Her having her there obviously is only going to a lifting, what do they call it? A rising sea lifts all boats, something like that. A rising ocean lifts all boats. So she's there to offer her work, her ability, where she's not trying to take over. She's like, let me just work. Give me the people you've already seen. Give me the people you don't have time to see. Give me the whatever. And I'll do women and children too. Like, she doesn't care. She will not say no. And obviously, because if she were in it for the ego, she would have said, F this. And she couldn't have left because she was there with Jamie. But if she were in it for the ego, she would have said, F this. You take care of all the dudes and the women and the children. She did it because she's not in it for the ego, right? She genuinely wants to help. And I do think the dude wants to help too. But he's a man of that time, blah, blah, blah. So I think she is not only, what do you call it? She's not only, not suffering, what's the word? Challenges. He feels, she's not openly challenging, like actively challenging, but he feels her presence. Number one, any woman's presence in that area is probably a challenge, and usually probably women aren't hanging around. Number two, the fact that she says she's a doctor, like, how dare she? Women aren't doctors. So the fact that she's there, and it probably makes it even harder because she is married to this colonel of militia who does have standing there. So he can't full out like stab a bitch because then, you know, but here's the thing though. He knows he can't, he's not going to hurt her, but he knows he can't like get away with like slashing her throat and saying, get out, evil woman. Right. Because then he would be taken into custody. And the thing is, here's the thing. And he knows that, number one, but also if he did, and if he were, who loses? Not only him, his life or his freedom, the people he's helping lose. So it's a really big fat ball of misogyny and patriarchy and ego and all the crap.
Do you ever find yourself questioning the veracity of anyone else's claim to be, oh, it's my calling to be a doctor? Uh-huh. Did you feel like...
In real life, you mean, or in a book?
No, in the book, like that everyone else's calling was maybe less as big of a calling than Claire's was because of how much she had to overcome to become what she is. Every time you encounter like a male doctor, you're just like, meh.
I don't know that I would look at it as less than, but certainly not as hard won, and certainly not maybe as meaningful because of what she absolutely has had to go through in multiple centuries, by the way.
Okay. Absolutely.
Sorry, that made me laugh. Okay.
She really needs to go to the future. I bet she'd be pretty useless now.
That's true. She's like, she wouldn't be very helpful in 2023. That's kind of sad, nope. But probably not wrong. Ian, meanwhile, is taking out foraging parties now and again. I don't know if it's in the book. I didn't write it down, but I don't believe it is. I don't know if he's taking out foraging parties of like of Americans or of Continentals, or people who are part of the American military or hanging out with him, or if he's taking out foraging parties of other Indians. I don't know, but he's just taking out foraging parties is what he's doing. Roger.
What do you think they are foraging?
When I hear of foraging, it's usually like food and supplies.
I know.
And by supplies, I mean stuff from nature that you can then reuse as something.
Like
tree bark.
I imagine
don't know.
The urban foragers that are all over TikTok right now. They're like, oh, here's a... here's a weed that they don't want you to know about and everything you can do with it.
Actually, that's funny because if I heard the word urban forager, then I absolutely would consider it, you know, plants, flowers, nature stuff. Mm-hmm. But also because of the word urban, I'd think like an old, I don't know, an old shoe. Something you found in the ground. You know what I mean? I would think, and to me, urban foraging, like all bets are off, meaning it's not, I would not think it's solely natural substances. It could be also man-made.
So
stuff.
Would you say like mudlarking is like urban foraging?
Foraging probably not, because they can't take the stuff and use it in for their own goods later on. Mudlarking specifically, if they find something, they don't own it. I mean, they can, some, if it's, that's not true. If it's not of worth, I think they can keep it, I think. But remember the process, like there's a process, you have to have like a license and you have to, I know you have to turn some things over. So I am not remembering the specific detail about whether you can keep anything or not. I think what happens is whatever you find, you turn in. I mean, if you find a like piece of a leaf, like who cares? But if you find anything that might be something, you have to turn it in. And then once it's registered or they look at it and they don't give a rat's, then they offer it back to you, I think. I think that's what we found out from our mudlarking interview, which is on our other podcast, the All Souls Podcast, which I promise you we have not forgotten about, although it has been a bit. Roger has ordered back with to the letters paused back in the 1980s. Roger has ordered some new books about the American Revolution, and they go, so after they read this letter and find out where her parents are and what's going on, they go to his new books and read about Ticonderoga. The chapter ends with a tiny little excerpt of a letter, not even a whole letter. King George III to Lord, I think it's George, but Germain or Germain, says, Burgoyne is to take the corps from Canada to Albany. You must include Indians.
And that was chapter 34. Trucking forward to chapter 35, entitled Ticonderoga.
Clear POV, June 12, 1777. So it's as if the letter continued, but it's not a letter. It's a real life. Fort Ticonderoga, they're still there. So clear POV, as I said, no more boat. No more boat for now. We're not done wholly. As she said in the letter, they still plan on going to Scotland. Jamie mostly spends his days outside helping where help is needed. Currently, that means building a bridge. And Claire is playing doctor. I mean, yes, she's a doctor, but I just like saying playing doctor. With the women and children she's allowed to treat. As far as their residence or their quarters, they stay in a small attic room in this building. And the chapter opens with Claire washing herself very carefully because she had just been doctoring a boy whom she is sure has mumps, and she does not want to pass it on to Jamie. And during this little scene, she makes an odd move or like, you know, missteps or something, and her knee like does not give out, but it like cracks, and she's like, or you know, creaks, and her knee is definitely still giving her grief. And so after talking about it, they knock boots,
because that's what I do to make my knee feel better every time.
It's actually precisely what they did and why, because he literally said, when you love me, nothing hurts. So she goes, okay, that's why they literally why they did it. You are being funny. I'm being real.
I can be both. I could be both funny and real.
I did say you couldn't. In this instance, you're being funny. So even though Claire has been, as we said, forbidden from doctoring men, she's still working on Captain Stebbings. How could this be, you might ask? Well, because Captain Stebbings, first of all, demanded it, number one. And number two, Captain Stebbings was being protected by that really ferocious looking guinea dick. And he's a looker, basically. He's a looker, and he's a scary looker.
Did you
looker.
Say his name?
So,
was?
Guinea Dick made sure no one
Could
else
you
say came.
That name again?
Came to Guinea Dick. Oh, Guinea like guinea pig, Dick like
I know,
a dong.
But it sounds like a slur.
Okay.
And guinea I'm dick. Like and I do not recall hearing Davina say it. So every time you say it, I'm like, wait, what? What is his name?
So basically, Captain Stebbings, knowing that he's protected by Guinea Dick, He's like, nope, well, she's the only one who's going to work on me. So she was able to remove, she had been able to remove the tube that she'd put in with like the with using the, I guess the feather.
The quill
from his chest. So that was an improvement. And Guinea Dick had been given a chance to join the Continental Army, but he refused, instead selecting to stay with Captain Stebbings and be a POW. You gotta have respect for that. So Claire's now out and about. So she had just gone back to her attic hovel with Jamie. She washes off the mumps, hurts her knee, they boff. She relaxes maybe a little bit, and then she gets up and goes out in the middle of the night. Because this is like really like the only actual pleasant time of day. It's like she's like between 10 and 2 a.m. So she needed her nightly walk. No, she went outside checking on patients. They'd been at Fort Ticonderoga for 32 days. As she's out, she runs into Ian. Ian says that he'd heard from some visiting Huron Indian that General Burgoyne had planned to convince loads of Indians to fight for him and overwhelm the Americans. Ian had already told Jamie about this. And the reason he's telling Claire, the reason he's told her about Burgoyne not so much, but the fact that he had met with a Huron Indian is this person he'd met with had said he had known him or known his wife. And what does Ian want to talk about? He wants to talk about babies. He wants to know why he can't make one. So she does her best to explain fertility or infertility. And he shares that, as I said, one of the women with the Huron knew him and told him that Emily had a living child currently, like now, a live child. And he doesn't think it's right, thinking of himself now going forward, like when they get to Scotland or whether he stays in the colonies. He doesn't think it's right for him to wed someone without telling her. Obviously he's going to tell her, but it's like, if I can't sire children and I tell her that, like, it's not, I have to tell her that before I wed, and someone may not want to wed me. So blah, blah, blah. And so he wants his aunt to look at his parts to see if there's something wrong.
I don't think you, sorry, I'm going to just stop.
That's okay. Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking about, there are so very few fertility problems that are visible externally.
By looking at someone's guinea dick, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm just saying, because we, sure, Ian, we can look at it, but I mean, unless he's
no,
got,
Ian,
like...
No, Ian, let's not.
Unless,
we're related.
Like, unless he's, like, got one ball attached to his,
unless
like...
Unless he's playing the role of, what's the dude who got the clap or the sif and then took off and came back, or, sorry, is not back yet.
That...
The German
was
dude.
Almost rhyming for a minute there, to the point that it was distracting. What you just said... was almost rhyming.
I did not rhyme.
Just almost rhyming enough to be distracting.
I said he got the clap, and I mean the sif, and then he took off and he came back.
Uh-huh. Clapping back.
Okay.
They were sounding very...
You thought I was going to rap later. About STDs?
It wouldn't be the first time.
It would be the first time. I've never rapped about STDs. I don't... First of all, I don't rap.
I mean, you sang about it.
Yeah. That was one of the... I still remember those... That was a favorite. That was a great song.
I know you do.
Yes. And I loved it because, and Lene, I just loved hearing Lene. I love Lene singing it. I just want to sing it with her one day again. Okay, so she asks him to look at his guinea dick. And she's like, thank you, no. But she's like, let's do this. Let's ask you a few questions. I'll take a history, okay? She goes, was the child, your live child, the child that you had that died with Emily, did you find out? Did you see it? Did you find out in any way if it were deformed in any way? And he says, no. Claire continues. Then she tells him that they have more chat, which we don't hear. And then Diana writes that she tells him she thinks it could possibly be an RH problem. And she explains it. I'm not going to explain it. And she goes, it's just bad luck. No one's fault. And, you know, with luck, you know, especially if you... The next person with luck, especially, so no, most European women are RH positive. And so if you choose to be with a European woman with luck, it will not happen again. You'll have no problem going forward. It was just bad luck. And the next day Ian was gone.
You know, after hearing this chapter, I immediately got on Google and I was like, where do most people who have RH negative are they descended from? And I couldn't find that answer. But I was curious because I'm Rh negative. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm an aberration.
Oh, stop it.
No matter where you stick me, I'm an aberration. So, most of my like ancestry.com DNA stuff goes back to England, Ireland,
but that is Northern Europe. I mean, I know there's a separate section called Northern Europe, which is like Germany, Norway, but technically, because it's still part of Europe. But yes, the British Isles plus Ireland.
Right. And I'm wondering if it's more prevalent there than like solidly European continental blood.
Yeah. Who knows? It's definitely, anyway, as Claire said, most European women, not all. Most. So yeah.
And wraps up chapter 35, moving right along to chapter 36, entitled The Great Dismal.
Okay, remember that little bit that I said to click save and control S and save it, and then we'll come back to it? William, last time we were with William, he had been tasked/asked to do this little jaunt for Captain Ezekiel Richardson, and that was to take a cipher to some loyalists in Virginia, right? We didn't have like more detail than that. It is June 21st, 1777. Let me go back and read a date. Okay, so this is just a few weeks. So the last time we were, the last chapter, it's June 12th at Fort Ticonderoga, and now it's June 21st, 1777. William is on another adventure, this time into the Great Dismal. This, remember that thing? This is his thing. This is his on the way to Canada trip that's not on the way to Canada. Doing a thing for a dude who's a guinea dick, okay? He's riding his horse on a road, but the road isn't long. It doesn't last very long. And he's been in the Dismal before. He's not afraid, but he does know that it can be dangerous. He's on his way to a place literally called Dismal Town. He keeps repeating to himself several names because this is either the information or these are the people he's supposed to get the information to. And he keeps repeating Washington, Cartwright, Harrington, Carver. This was the list of names he'd been given by Richardson. He was told they were the names of loyalist gentlemen from Dismal Town.
You could totally sing that to My Favorite Things.
Washington, Cartwright, Harrington, and Carver. That? Uh-huh. Okay. You're funny.
That's how I would have remembered it on the walk.
I don't think The Sound of Music was written yet, but I would have too.
I know. I'm just saying.
He could have done... What's the tune? My Country Tis of Thee. Because that's God Save the Queen, King, whatever. Washington, Cartwright, Harrington, Carver. These are the names.
Mine's
Washington,
better.
Washington, Cartwright, Harrington. Actually, not so bad. Harrington, Carver. And then for the first phrase of each line, maybe the rest of it, no.
Washington, Cartwright, and Harrington, Carver. Da, da, da. These are the people that I am to charter. I shall be looking for these four people. I don't know. It's fun.
Keep going.
No, I'm good.
Y'all, we don't get a lot from Summer, which is why I shut up. When she does something like that, we got to let her go. Encourage it, girls, ladies, gentlemen, all of them. Okay, so this is what he had been given by Richardson. He was told of the names of loyalist gentlemen from Dismal Town. What does he think of the road alone? Sorry, what is William thinking of on the road alone, besides keeping those names in his brain? Women. The one small book he brought with him was Harris's List of Covent Garden Ladies. Now, we find out later on, he'd brought it, I'm sure, to entertain himself, maybe, but he'd used it as a cipher to basically help remember the information he was supposed to be sharing, whatever. So this was his little way of keeping things secret, and it wouldn't be really thought much of in case someone found him and frisked him and took control over him or arrested him, whatever, frisked him and found a book. They just think, oh, he's a dude being a dude. Like, so it was a pretty actually smart way to have a cipher, hide your cipher, whatever. But that's a little bit later in the chapter. So he's got this book of lady hers, basically. His father had found him and a friend looking through the book when he was younger and had then taken him and his friend to Mrs. McNabb's brothel, and him and his friend were introduced to the wows of the flesh. Now pause here for a second.
How is that your first reaction?
Well, hold on. For a man of the time, I can see how it might be your reaction. Like, oh, they're going to get into something. I don't want them like getting into trouble with girls. We have to, not correct. We have to, keep this, not necessarily foster the interest, not correct the interest, but keep it in line. So if you're going to do this, we're going to do it safely and privately and the way it's supposed to be done, right? Quote,
no.
Unquote. The
no,
only
that is,
thing,
that
hold
is
on,
not
hold
the
on, the
first
only thing I have
reaction.
An issue with, Summer, I get it. I'm not defending it. I'm saying I understand how he could, Lord John. My issue isn't necessarily, surprisingly, maybe to you or others, from a 20th century response, absolutely weird. From 18th century, noble person, aristocrat, absolutely not weird.
But there couldn't have been like a, there should have been a transitionary conversation that happened between those moments.
I don't disagree. And there probably was. We don't get everything on the page. The thing that like shocks me is not what Lord John did to/for/with whatever.
But it's just
William,
his buddy's friend.
That's his son by law. The thing that I don't get is why he took his friend and did it. There's nothing. We have no proof that he called the friend's dad. We have no proof that he called a friend's mom.
Yeah, but this is how he doesn't tattle.
What? How the friend? Oh, how the friend doesn't tattle?
If you take the kill. Yeah, if you take. Yeah, because then he won't tell anybody anything scandalous about it happening because
so
he was there.
He's ensuring
that
his silence by getting
himself.
Him laid.
Yeah, he purchased his silence with booty.
With booty and booby. So it was a Marjorie that he'd fallen. He is introduced to the wows of the flesh by a Marjorie. And he'd fallen in love. After a week, he'd planned to propose marriage. But he ended up speaking with another lass while he waited for Marjorie to arrive. And then Marjorie arrives and he realized she was with another dude and was doing with the other dude the thing that she'd done with him. And he was appalled. And that was the end of that love affair. Back to real time, he realizes that road that he knew was short and, you know, he was thankful for had disappeared as he was tuned out. He and his horse are now walking through the mud. As soon as you mention a horse and a man and mud, my tender 80s child heart automatically goes to where, Summer?
Atreyu.
Yes. Oh, no. Atreyu's the dude. Artex. Artex. Sorry, I wrote it down wrong too. Yeah, Atreyu. I did put Atreyu, and that's true, but holy smokes. If y'all know, you know. The never ending story. Never ending story.
Say my name.
That was not a great note. Yes. He gets off the horse and takes out his canvas from his sack somewhere and puts it over his head because it's raining, and they continue. They have a hard go of it. William ends up falling off the horse. The horse is now caught in the mud. He covers the horse's eyes with the canvas and is able to help it out. And then the horse just F's off. Quote, something long, drab, and extremely fast passed less than 2 paces from him. Something big, unquote. That's a no from me, dog. I wouldn't be going after the horse either. I don't want to see what that thing was.
Yeah, the horse had a good idea.
So what did William?
Get away from it.
No.
That's what I'm saying.
So what did, exactly. What did William then realize? He was lost. He was lost. On foot, without food, fire, or any shelter. Even his watch had stopped. And the book of the floozies was gone. Did I say far? I meant fire. He eventually goes after the horse. I mean, not kind of like half-heartedly. He like starts off in the direction the horse had fled. So who knows? Which he never found, by the way. But he did find, I don't know why this makes me laugh. He didn't ever find the horse, but he did find 2 items that had flung off the horse in its escape. A packet of tobacco and a frying pan. I don't know how random that, I don't know why it makes me laugh, but it does.
I mean, I could find uses. At least you could trade with the tobacco and you could, I've seen Rapunzel. That's a weapon.
I was like, Rapunzel and hair? What? Got it.
Tangled. Frying pan entangled.
So he's hanging out in the protection of a tree, like I'm guessing in the outgrowth of a tree, in the hollow of a tree, I don't know. And then the tree is hit by lightning. And in all of this lightning shenanigans, a piece of wood is like shoved into his arm. And he's got a massive splinter. He pulls out what he can. And he's still got a lot of like splinters and actual pieces of wood in his arm, though he can't get out. He recalls being lost. Because now it's all foggy. And this makes him recall being lost in the fog before as a child. And so there's a whole passage or three about things that had happened as a child and how Mac had found him, all of that, which...
This whole scene made me think of The Others.
I haven't seen The Others.
You haven't?
No. Do I need to?
Yeah.
Is it an 80s movie?
No. It was the early... I think it was like the either late 90s or early 2000s, but Nicole Kidman was in... And they're in... It's like a ghost story, but you find out...
I'm not going to tell you
the end of it. That was stupid. I almost just said...
That's okay, but is it scary?
I think it's scary, but not like... Not scary, scary. Not in the way that you think is going to be scary. But it's more like, yeah. But then it also takes place...
I can handle spooky. I can't do scary, really.
You watched Hill House. You can watch this.
Okay, fair. But Hill House was art.
Oh, okay.
Was freaking art.
Oh, this one, you could call this... I'm just saying, you could call this art, too. I don't know. I'm not art shaming.
The Others is not based on a classic horror novel.
I don't know.
That I know. That's true. I could be totally wrong and making a fool of myself.
Bottom line. Oh my God. Bottom line. This house is in the middle of nowhere. And in the middle of the day, the fog rolls in. Every day at a certain time, the fog rolls in. And when she walks out into the fog, she's trying to get out because they've been trapped at this house for however long. And I think the husband's supposed to be like off at war or something like that. And so they've been isolated. So every day she tries to go out and get away or try to see if she can get to town or find somebody or anything. And she goes out in the fog and she can, when she's in the fog and it's the fog that's so thick, you can't see through, you can't see your own hand. Right. It's that thick. She hears things in the fog. So that's what this whole thing made me think of, her being out in the fog, not being able to see anything, but hearing voices and that kind of situation.
Well, I will have to watch that then.
Do it.
I've heard the title. I know I've heard of it. I don't know that I've seen it. So yeah, all of that stuff is a memory. Back in real time, he runs into a snake. He makes a spear out of wood. He gets away from the snake and he's still lost.
So like either these were really only the tragedies or the scary things of the time, or snakes, boats, and
catamounts
are like the biggest dangers. In this time period.
I mean, illness is probably the biggest danger, infection.
I know, but it's like if there's a danger that comes across, it's an exciting section. There's a snake, or there's going to be a boat, or there's going to be a... There's a third one, and I can't come up with it right now. Moving right along to chapter 37, entitled Purgatory.
On the third day, William finally finds the lake. The wound in his arm was hot and throbbing, so infection. As I said... A snake had found him. It was a water moccasin. I don't do bugs and I don't do snakes. I don't want them. I don't want harm to come to them. I just do not want them in front of me or near me or in my house. Like I cannot watch, probably because of snakes, but it's not just snakes now. I cannot eat a meal. I can eat a meal and watch TV. I cannot eat a meal and watch any kind of animal show, any kind. I mean, I maybe like kittens, but I can't watch like a National Geographic, even if it's not really violent. I cannot. And I think that all stems to, you know, the close-ups of the snake in its mouth. And I want to barf. This is the most determined snake I've ever heard of.
I have issues with animals that don't have eyelids.
That are what?
That don't have eyelids. So they never blink. Oh. So they just stare the whole time. And snakes don't have eyelids.
That's gross.
And some lizards don't have them. But it's like they just stare at you. That's why I don't like those kinds of animals. But I could totally eat and watch a snake.
Oh, no. Gross. Blah. So this water moccasin is like chasing him. Not running because it doesn't have legs. But it is totally chasing him. As he's running from the snake, he runs into two Indian men. One of the men, he communicates, snake, and they know like what he's saying. And one goes out to the snake and he gives them, okay, so then that's a little skirmish. He comes back. And then they talk a little bit, not too much, because these men are also speaking in their own language in front of William. But I don't know if they ask or if William offers, but he doesn't get a good feeling from these dudes. And so he... offers them or either offers them tobacco or answers the question, yes, I have tobacco, whatever. He gives them tobacco and he throws his tobacco at them and takes off. And then one of them runs after him And as he's running, he hears, I'm guessing, he hears, Diana writes, he hears pigs and then sees a giant wolf. He hears the pigs before he sees them, and then he runs into a giant wolf, a.k.a. our Rollo.
Yay, Rollo.
Who is never too far behind Ian.
Or in this chapter, Murray. So if you get confused.
Oh, Muddy. Yes, Muddy. So Ian gets rid of the other Indians by telling them, just he does, like say, I'll take care of this dude. You know, no, you're not going to do what you think you're going to do. Just go away. He basically tells them like they were afraid of me because I'm Mohawk. Ian tells William that the two Indians wanted to take him west and sell him as a slave.
Hot.
So he was right. He was right to trust his gut. William introduces himself and Ian says, yeah, I know you. Mm-hmm. We've met. He doesn't give him much more than that, though. Ian helps remove
you're
the rest of the splinter.
You're not quite a wee bastard anymore, though.
No. He helps remove the rest of the splinter from William's arm by cutting it all the way open. And then after he's done picking out what he can, he pulls a Jenny, pulls a his mother, and pours boiling water into the wound. Which is, to me, that's got to hurt more than the cutting and the picking. I cannot contemplate that. I cannot contemplate that. And it makes me, I cannot imagine that. And then after he does that, he covers the wound. Of course, as we know, Jenny did the same thing. It's to avoid, prevent
infection.
I know,
but how does that not cook him a little bit?
Cook his meat?
Yeah.
Literally.
Because that's what
I'm sure
think
it does.
Of,
like some of the.
Because having, I mean, I cook meat.
It reminds me of, what do you call it? It's fondue chinois.
It makes me think of that too, but it's like if I took a chicken thigh that had skin on it still, and if I just dipped the skin portion of it into the water, it would cook the skin portion of it. And having that knit back together with another piece that also had all of the endings of it cooked doesn't make sense to me. I'm just imagining this giant, open, gapey flap wound, unless they cut that off and do it all over again.
Yeah, it would be interesting to talk to a doctor about that and say, hey, I understand this could probably help prevent infection, but how much tissue damage are you really doing? Like, obviously, some is being cooked, literally. William asks Ian if they were near the Great Dismal. Ian says, yeah, no. William finds out that he'd likely been given the names of rebels by Richardson, which meant ... You can draw your own conclusion. There's a little bit, he thinks about it a little bit more, but later in the chapters we still have, but draw your own conclusions. So he was told by Richardson, he was given the names of loyalists, and because one of the names is Washington, and Ian confirms that probably any Washington within 300 miles, something like that, from that area was somehow related to General Washington, is like, oh, this is not good. He asks Ian how he could be a Mohawk. And he's like, let me tell you.
Ooh, do I got a story for you? Sit down. You don't got nowhere to be for a while, right?
Yes. And even tells him about, he tells him about his time with the Mohawk. He even educates him about death songs. William falls asleep. Later when he awakes, he's surrounded by Indians. He learns these are Ian's kinsmen. His arm is now swollen and infected. One of the Indians, a man named Glutton, cuts open William's shirt because it was like bursting already. His shirt was no longer fitting over his arm. And he says, as they work on his arm, he says, think of a strong animal to focus on. And William chooses the bear. Later, as the Indians split up, a few of them staying with Ian and William, showing them the way to a small settlement that had a doctor. And as they make their way, William, delusional, has a conversation with the cat.
I mean, does that make you delusional?
No, I have actual cats.
Okay. I'm like, because you have conversations with cats all the time.
That are sitting next to me, yes.
So that was chapter 37. Moving at a fast pace now to chapter 38, entitled Plain Speech.
In which we meet the Hunters. Rachel Hunter was the sister of the doctor who was in this settlement that the Indians had mentioned. It was Dr. Denzel Hunter. Denzel is Davina says. So we'll say Denzel. William was staying there, recuperating. Denzel Hunter had helped with the arm, of course, and it was doing better too.
How gross was that, though?
Very gross.
He was like, he was going to cut it off. And he said it was just the pressure of going into to cut it, like to hit it with a knife, and it the abscess burst. I was like, bleh. That's like Dr. Pimple Popper on like crack.
Which another thing I cannot watch. We find out that the hunter's parents were both dead. So they were both orphans. William's thinking again about the possibility that I told you would come back. Possibility that Richardson hadn't been mistaken in his intelligence and had sent William to death on to end up dead or to be imprisoned. William wants to shave before even leaving bed, it seems. And so they have to kind of make plans for that. As he finds out that they'd taken, of course, they'd had to undress him to doctor him, and they had him in a creek for a little bit because he'd had a high fever. And so when they did that, they had removed his wooden rosary he had around his neck. And so that's why Denzel thought he was Catholic, but they returned it to him. And William's eager to leave, but Denzel says it will be at least 4 or 5 days more before you're able to even walk on your own, let alone go around. And William does share that he's headed to Canada.
And we're going to wrap up this episode with chapter 39 entitled A Matter of Conscience.
William is on the mend. He's practicing walking. He looks out of the window that Rachel, and he sees down below, Rachel is chatting with Ian. Ian's asking if William will live. And William waves down at them from his window. And what he sees is that Ian gives the horse's reins to Rachel and then gets on another horse that he has there and he rides away. So that other horse, he believes, must be for him. He had gone downstairs, which they really hadn't wanted him to yet, and were not expecting him. And so when Rachel comes in, she's startled. And he asks, like, okay, what did he say? What did he say? What did Ian tell you? And she says, Ian left with no information for William. He'd asked after his health, William's health. He gave her the horse and then left. But he had given her something, if not information. He'd given her a pouch with some money and a letter and another item. Quote, a, quote, gift from a friend whom the Indians call Bear Killer. He hopes that you will wear it in good health, unquote. And that was in his letter. So that makes me question, because I don't think Ian keeps all this stuff around with him, right? I mean, some stuff, but not other people's stuff. So that makes me think, in the time that after he had brought William safely to the hunters, he had gone to Ticonderoga, told Jamie about William, and then Jamie had given him the bear necklace, whatever. And then Ian, probably while he was there, he may not have gotten the extra horse from Jamie or two horses, but that's where he got at the very least the bear necklace, right? So, and then he comes back to the hunters and he's dropping off a horse and dropping off this the letter, the money, and the necklace for William, and he takes off. William thinks, quote, what could have caused the odd Scottish Indian to take such an interest in him? Methinks you might find out later in the book, William.
I mean,
maybe
Ian did spend time telling people that he was his cousin. And I know that he probably thought he was like, oh, well, he's just saying that to be nice. Or maybe they just consider all white people related or to protect him. When the whole time he wasn't even doing it ironically. He's like, this is my cousin.
Or to protect him. Yeah. So Rachel, he's like, ma'am, I can tell that you've read this letter. And he confronts her and she apologizes. But she's a spirited lass. She tells him that she and her brother are leaving in a few days and William is welcome to join them for as long as they're on their trip north. Because they're selling their house and they've already sold the animals. And Denny is going to join up as a doctor with the American Continental Army. But in telling him this, she also talks more about how they're Quakers and that they were put out of meeting in Philadelphia. They were put out of meeting because they, or maybe among other things, but the main reason was that because they, unlike other friends, were not loyalists. And she goes on to say, after their parents had died, someone had searched for their relatives, like, you know, in the colonies. And of course, you know, sent out letters to England, and they found that they had a living relative named John Hunter, who was in London. He was a doctor. And so since Denny was, you know, smart, intelligent, had, you know, he had skills, it was decided that Denny would go to London to study with this doctor, to also become a doctor. And someone, a good woman, took Rachel in and basically taught her, you know, housekeeping, how to keep a home so she could later keep her own home or her brother's home or her husband's home. And we do not have a date for when he went and came back, but it's probably in the last year or so, maybe a few years, because now they're at the point where they're going to join the army. And that was his, maybe not right away whole purpose, but that was, it's their purpose now. So yeah, so we learned about how Denzel became a doctor. And we also learn that he's going to become a surgeon with the Continental Army, and Rachel is going to follow him.
I love them.
I me too.
Like, they are some of the few characters that Diana, like, just jettisons onto the screen for you or the page for you that I instantly want to spend more time with. Most of the other people I have to kind of barter with myself. And I was like, fine, I will listen to this person talk if you can get me back to the other storyline I was interested in. But this one always caught me from the beginning because they're just two such interesting characters that I want to know more about them. And they are probably what actually got me interested in William more the first time.
Yeah, I think they help. Not trying to be rude when I say this, and I don't hate William, but if you are bored by William, or if you are someone who really doesn't like William yet, the Hunters, especially Rachel, but the Hunters, yeah, I think his time with the Hunters, or what he goes through with the Hunters, not just in this chapters, but in the future, you know, his arc, I guess, with the Hunters, it definitely, I think, not that we didn't think he was human, but I think it humanizes him more. It endears him to us more. You know what I mean? Because he suffers a little bit, and he, you see his heart, and you see he can be a little guinea dick, but he also has softness, and he wants what's best for people whom he cares for. So yeah, I can absolutely see that.
And that will be the end of this read-along. Join us next time when we will continue our An Echo in the Bone read-along. Echo in the Bone read-along with chapters 40, The Blessing of Bride and Michael, chapter 41, Shelter from the Storm, which will end part 4 and start us into part 5. We're straddling another one, To the Precipice, with 42, Crossroads, 43, Countdown, 44, Friends, and 45, Three Arrows.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Lisa S. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you don't have anywhere online to go and talk to other people about your Outlander fascinations, come join us at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And if you're just dying to have some Outlander Pod branded merch, I've got a shop for you. Go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
If you haven't subscribed to our newsletter, it's free. The Outlander Pod Gazette awaits you. Please join us. Find us at outlanderpod.com/newsletter. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.